Indicated there, I want tonight for us to look at this prophet, the prophet Nahum, the message that he had for his people, what it means for them and what it means for us. Let me start by asking the question, when did we last hear a sermon from the prophet Nahum? In Spurgeon's series of sermons, there are 3,561 sermons, and four of them are on the prophet Nahum. Like we saw when we were looking at Joel last week, there is little detail given to us about him, very little biography. All that we were told who Joel's father was last time. For Nahum, we're told what tribe or nation or area he came out of. The vision of Nahum, the Elkoshite. Where is Elkosh? We don't know. And again, that's all that we are told about this man, Nahum. So what was the time scale? When was he speaking and living? And what's the time frame for his message before us here? Well, we spoke there and mentioned there chapter 3 and verse 8, art thou better than populace? No. Now that's a reference to the city of Thebes. And Thebes was captured by the Assyrians in the year 663. And the city of Nineveh, to whom Nahum spoke, and perhaps this should have been said right at the very beginning when I was giving the reading. The prophecy of Nahum is directed against the fall of the city of Nineveh. The city of Nineveh is the capital city of the Assyrians. Remember the way we put it, A, B, and C? The Assyrians were the first ones that opposed God's people, then the Babylonians, then Cyrus, A, B, and C. So it's the first group of those that came against God's people, the Assyrian nation. The capital city was Nineveh. And from the history we know that the capital city of Nineveh fell in the year 612. So this book, Nahum, is written after the capture of Thebes, 663, and before the capture of Nineveh in 612. That's as far as we can go in putting a time frame round these words. So what's the setting? The setting of this prophet is in the king of Syria, the king of Judah was Manasseh rather, and Manasseh's reputation is given to us in 2 Kings chapter 21 and verse 9, where we're told that Manasseh did more evil than many of the other kings who had gone before him. That's the kind of reputation that Manasseh had in Judah. So it is no wonder to us then that Assyria was being used to correct God's people. So we're beginning to develop a historical picture between 663 and 612. The nation of Assyria came against these people, Judah. And the reputation of the Assyrians was fearful. We're going to think of it in a minute, but just a flavor of it. They were known for their barbarity and their cruelty against all those whom he captured, indulging in grotesque torture, prolonging death, making people suffer, using that as an instrument to quell any kind of rebellion and to put a sheet and a blanket over any city they captured, any nation they had, any people they took away. So if that's the kind of setting that we've got, why? Why do we have this book Nahum, 47 verses? Why do we have Nahum directing his prophecy about the capture of a city and the destroying of a nation? What is so important about these events that happened thousands of years ago? What's so important about them that we have a prophecy directed against them, recorded for us in our Bibles. Let's start then by going to the prophet that just come before Nahum. Let's go to the prophet Micah. Micah chapter 6 and verse 9. Micah chapter 6 and verse 9. And we'll read there these words. The Lord's voice crieth unto the city, and the man of wisdom shall see thy name. Hear ye the rod, and who hath appointed it? And that phrase at the end, hear ye the rod, and who hath appointed it? The rod here is a reference to the instrument the Lord was raising up and using to correct his own people. So the rod reference in chapter 6 and verse 9 is a reference to the Assyrian nation that God was raising up to correct his own people. And they did so. But in doing so, they stepped over the mark. The cruelty of the Assyrians was something fearful. So side by side with Micah 6 and 9, we need to put Isaiah chapter 10. Again, it's important that we get this carefully in our minds. Isaiah chapter 10. What was it that provoked this kind of prophecy of Nahum? Isaiah 10 and verse 5. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send them against a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give them a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. That's the remit, if you like, the instructions that was given by God to Assyria against his people. And then look what happened in verse 7. Howbeit, he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so. But it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. So in other words, here is Assyria, and he is not paying heed to the restrictions and limitations that God has imposed in putting him up as a rod against his people. The Assyrians are just going to wipe out not a few nations, many nations, rhetorical question. They're going to go against the people, and they're going to do so with such a barbarity and a brutality. Go down to verse 12. Wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work against Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, when the work is finished, listen to what he says, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. That reference to high looks, we all know it to mean the pride that is in this king as he goes and sweeps up nations and countries and cities before him over a 250 year period. For he says, verse 13, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent. And I have removed the bounds of the people, and have robbed their treasures, and have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. And you read the rest of Isaiah 10. Later on, you can see the way in which it goes over and describes, if you have this key, if you go over it and read it as the way in which Assyria was used, but the way in which overstepped the mark in its cruelty, brutality against those people who they went out against. So that's the background of Nahum. And will Assyria escape? If Assyria is going out in such a blood-curdling way as the nation in the ascendancy and supreme in that area, if the Assyrians are behaving in this way, will they get off with it? This book, Nahum, is addressing these Christian people. They are suffering, extreme. They are bewildered at their circumstances. And they're suffering as the Lord's people. And here is Nahum coming. And he is coming with a message telling them that although this might be the supremacy of Nineveh, and although the Assyrians might be the one strong nation, and there's no other obvious contenders against it, nevertheless, Nahum goes to encourage the people that the city is going to be destroyed. We can see the application of ourselves that evil manifests itself in different forms down through the years and across all different peoples. There are severe trials to what we believe of the power and of the care of God. One of the Psalms asks the question, is there knowledge in the heavens high of things and earth below? Does God know? And we can see if somebody is in an extreme circumstance, if we try to paint suffering at the hands of the Assyrian, there can be this question coming to the mind. Does God know? And so Nahum comes to give encouragement. And especially, we read of it, chapter 2 and verse 13, chapter 3 and verse 5, same phrase, I am against you. The word to the Ninevites, to the Assyrians, God is against them. And the Lord will bring deliverance to his people. So what I want to do, just to go through this book, is to look at a pile. And at the bottom of the pile, we have God's people. The people of God. Chapter 1 and verse 7. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that trust in him. But with an overflowing flood, he will make an utter end of the place thereof, and darkness shall pursue his enemies. Then it goes on and speaks about the way in which they are bound. For now I will break his yoke from off thee, and burst thy bonds in sunder. These words, describing God's people from chapter 1:7 through to chapter 2:2. The way in which it describes them, they're needing refuge, they're needing protection. They are underneath a yoke, they're in bondage. They've been taken away by the Assyrians, the great empire of the day. And their capital city is Nineveh. Where is it? We hear a lot about Mosul in modern-day Iraq. Mosul, that's not too far away from where Nineveh was in the days of Nahum. And it was a tremendous city. There were two walls going right round the city. Two walls running for between 7 and 8 miles round the city. The inner wall was higher. It was 100 feet high. It was so broad you could get 3 chariots racing across the breadth of that wall. In front of the lower second wall out, there was a moat, 150 feet wide and 60 feet deep. The city of Nineveh was gigantic, intimidating. It seemed to be impregnable. In that day, it was second only to Babylon. That's how big it was, well defended, well resourced. These walls, this defense, this army of the Assyrians, blood-curdling. They would put the fear of death into any nation that they came against. Remember, Jonah preached amongst them about 100 years before this. They had repented then, but that was in the past. Now they were a nation on the ascendancy. They were extending the scope of their empire in ever-increasing circles outward to embrace and to take in other nations. They took in Israel, they took in the capital city of Israel, Samaria. Remember, we were thinking about it, 931 through the year 722. In the year 722, the Assyrians captured Samaria. The year 663, they captured Thebes, the wave coming out over the whole of the Middle East. They behaved like a prostitute. That's one of the illusions that we have in the third chapter. They came like a prostitute, wooing people, deluding people, taking a guard down sometimes, and then rob them and destroy them in a ruthless way. Or again, they would come against the city with the full-blooded resources of the army. They would kill everyone in the city. They would absolutely exterminate everyone in the city, and they would put back into that city others from other nations and other peoples. They would relocate them in the city so that they were strangers, outsiders from that immediate area, so that there was never a possibility of trouble coming from that city again. They used cruelty to subject those whom they captured. Cruelty on such a scale that it is not an exaggeration to put them in the same realm, the Assyrians, as the Nazi concentration camps, Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot in Cambodia, or the regime of Idi Amin in Uganda. That's the degree of evil and cruelty that the Assyrians indulged in when they went against people of their day. So you can understand how hard it was for the people of God to live in times like that. We have not quite parallels, but we have close similarities in our day, our recent days. Think of the gulags and the way in which the Christians were treated in Russia, or the Christians are treated in China, Tibet today. Or again, think even of some Muslim nations and the way in which to raise the name of Christ brings certain death upon you. The kind of philosophy we're seeing even coming in within our own boundaries. The plight was severe. These are the people of God then. We've touched on the people of God today. And as people of God today, we may not be in the same experiences with them, but we have the responsibility to pray for them and to support them as best we can. So that's the situation of God's people that Nahum was addressing. They are the bottom of the pile. So if you're at the bottom of the pile and you look up, what's the first thing you see? For these people, the first thing they saw was the Assyrian. And that's the second layer in the pile. The enemies of God. That's what's described for us in chapter 2, right through from chapter 2, verse 2, or chapter 2, verse 3, right through to the end of the chapter, the end of the book. They could see the Assyrians. Now, there's no rules of engagement then as we have today. You don't have to have approval from a home base for the kind of engagement or strategy you use. There's no such thing as the Geneva Convention in these days. There's no such thing as human rights in these days. They were the enemies of God, and they knew of no rules but the ones they made up themselves as to how they should treat or mistreat those that they captured. And we've got to remind ourselves of the perspective that Isaiah 40 gives us, that the nations are like a drop in a bucket, because God is not intimidated, God is not even challenged by the posturing of these people of Assyria. the enemies of God. We've already looked at and hinted at the kind of treatment they doled out to those whom they captured. But the important thing that we bring in here for ourselves and for Nahum and for his people is chapter 2 and verse 13. We've mentioned it, as well as chapter 3 and verse 5. Behold, again drawing attention to it, in the midst of all of their experiences, in the midst of all that they're going through, that's the word that the scripture says, look at this. Behold, I am against you. The same formula in verse 13 and in verse 5, stopping us in all of our thinking, in all of our living, and fixing our thoughts on this one certainty. I am against you. It is indeed a fearful message for ourselves. Because as we know the Lord's character, and as we know of what the Lord is capable, for somebody to say to us, the Lord is against you, that's a frightening message for us, because we know something of the Lord. But for these people, it had no effect whatsoever. Their time was running out. The patience of the Lord was long, but it was limited. They had crossed the line in the barbarity in which they engaged. Total destruction was now going to come upon them. They were going to be wiped out. Verse 14, the Lord hath given a commandment concerning thee, that no more of thy name shall be sown. There's going to be no more generation. They are going to be left standing in history at that point, that generation, and no one else. That's the way in which they're going to be treated and dealt with by God. And that's the essence of this book. God coming in when there is such barbarity, and comes in to judge those responsible. And what we have here is the phrase today, we have it, what goes around comes around. They're going to be paid in their own coin. Chapter 2, verse 11. It starts with a question, and an important thing is this question starts. Where is the dwelling of the lions? Where is the dwelling of the lions? And what he's saying here is that you Assyrians, you once behaved like lions. You once killed at your own pleasure and at your own whim. You once behaved in that way, but now the question is asked, where are you? And of course, it's because they've been paid in their own coin. They are now going to be hunted and exterminated just the same way as they, in their place, as lions, treated other nations. They are going to be wiped out and obliterated. As you tore up nations, so another nation is going to come and tear up you. What goes around comes around. You behave like a harlot. That's verse 4 of chapter 3. You behave like a harlot to entice and to draw in. Now what's going to happen to you? Behold, I'm against you, says the Lord of hosts, and I will discover, I will throw your skirts over your head. I will show the nation your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. You are going to become a spectacle. Just the same way as you made a spectacle of others, you're going to be paid in the same coin. Verse 19, there is no healing of thy bruise. Thy wound is grievous. You've bruised others. You've bruised others black and blue, and you've beaten them into the ground and into the dust. And there's going to be no healing when that comes round to you. The enemies of God, and the way in which Nahum is giving them clear intimation of what the Lord is going to do against them. And we note, just as we pass, the confidence with which Nahum spake. This was given at a time, we've described the city walls, we've described the size of the city of Nineveh. This is Nahum speaking when that there was the height, the strength of the city. And Nahum is coming and he's standing before him and he says, you're going to be all wiped out. Now, can you imagine the confidence that was required in Nahum to do that? Just the same as we were thinking on Sunday morning of the confidence that Paul had in speaking and sharing with the people in the boat that was under the storm, the way in which they would be kept safe as long as they stayed on board. There wasn't the slightest sign or indication of the storm abating or a rescue coming. But yet, that was a confidence with which Paul spoke. Here is the confidence with which Nahum speaks. How can a city and a people that are so well established and fortified, how can it be simply wiped away? The Medes and the Persians, the Medes and the Babylonians rather, with the Scythians, came against the city in the year 612. They put the siege round it. Well, they wouldn't be able to get past these walls. But then the providence of the Lord came. There was rain. The rivers rose. These sluice gates blocking out the two tributaries of the Tigris that had been closed for the security of the city when they were under siege. These were the very sluice gates that were forced open by the people that were putting the city to siege. And we read there in verse 6 of verse chapter 2, the gates of the river shall be opened and the palace shall be dissolved. And it's the word dissolved there. You think of when there's water running over mud, and it just wipes away the mud. Well, you think of a city that's built and the water there is undermining the foundations, and eventually the city wall collapses and the nations, the invading nations, can go in. That's what's been talked of here. Once their defense, now their weakness. And we find, as we go down, that those that came in chapter 2 and verse 9, the way in which they absolutely stripped this city bare. That's the way the Ninevites, the Assyrians, had treated other cities. They emptied the city of everything and anyone. This is them being paid in their same coin. These Babylonians that came in, take ye the spoil of silver, take the spoil of gold, for there is none end of the store and glory out of all the pleasant furniture. She is empty. The city of Nineveh was lost for 2,000 years. Everybody knew it from references and literature in different places, but it was only in the year 1842 that the city of Nineveh was found again. For almost 2,000 years, it was lost. There was nothing in it. When they went into it in 1842, there was nothing in it. You expect a city to have some historic relics and remnants. You expect something of a bygone generation to be still left there, buried underneath the sand, but there was nothing. Simply because of these verses and what God has said would happen to them because of the way in which they had behaved and treated other peoples. The only thing they found, the people that went in 1842, was they found layers of ash, substantial layers of ash, where every single thing in that city, if it wasn't removed, it was burnt. The city was left quite literally as an empty shell. Nineveh, it fell, and it fell hard. In one moment, it was the center of an empire. In a very brief moment, it became a relic of history. And surely the encouragement to these people that Nahum ministered was simply this: You cannot withstand God and hope to succeed. You cannot get away with sin and with evil on this scale. God simply will not allow it. He will not be mocked. And it applies in his day and it applies in our day still. No amount of power, no display of military might, no posturing amongst nations will succeed. Whatever is happening in Zimbabwe today, whatever is happening in other countries of our nation, power and might will not make false ideas right or cover up the wrong that has been done. God is a righteous God, and in an appropriate moment he will act and take to task those who seem in the eyes of men to be impregnable or invincible. And God's people will not be left in the clutches of such evil nations. There is therefore the application of the message of Nahum and also his name. His name? His name means comfort or consolation. And so you see the way in which the two things tie together, the message and the name. A consolation to God's people. Just the same way as Egypt, when the people of God came out of Egypt, and the Egyptians pursued after them, trying to recapture the slaves, then they said, "Stand still and see the salvation of God," and the Egyptians were lost in the sea. Come to the New Testament and you find that the Christian church is but a small handful. And what's it dealing with? It's dealing with a mighty Roman Empire. How are they going to succeed? A small handful against the might of the Roman Empire. And you go to Revelation chapter 4 and verse 2. And the vision that is given to them there is of heaven. And what's in the center of that vision? A throne. God is over the Assyrian Empire. God is over the Roman Empire. God is over the empires of today. And if we take it down to another level, to ourselves, at a personal level, we simply have a truth we know all too often. No trial will overwhelm us. No difficulty is too great for our God. We have the resources of God with us. He has overcome the world. He is building his church. And nothing but nobody can or will prevail against him in doing it. The people of God, the enemies of God, and who's on the top? God is sovereign. Right at the very beginning, chapter 1, verses 2 through to 8. God is jealous, and the Lord revengeth. Come down especially to verse 5. Talking about God, the mountains quake at him, and the hills melt, and the earth is burned at his presence. Yes, the world and all that dwell therein. Clear statement of God's sovereignty. God is a jealous God. He'll have no other gods before him. But that jealousy also is an indication of the way in which God has resolved to put into effect his plan and his standards. God's standards will apply, and the cruelty of the Assyrians go against it. And God will, in his time and way, rise up against them. We saw there last week in the way in which the Lord raised up the locusts, and in chapter 2:20 of Joel we're told that the Lord takes back the locusts. He does it with the Assyrians also. He raised them up as his rod to chastise and to correct the land of Judah and the people of Judah. But then they went over the score, and now the Lord raises up the Babylonians and the Medes and the Scythians. And he will bring them down because he is the sovereign God. He's not distant. He's not far removed or remote from his people. He's not indifferent to the behavior of nations or the treatment of his church. He is, and this is the important thing in verse 2, three times the word Lord is used, and the word that is used there brings forth the covenant-keeping God. He is the covenant-keeping God. Three times in verse 2, 10 times in this first chapter, the emphasis surely comes home to us. His eye roams over the face of the earth. He knows what's in the heart of man. He's familiar with the slightest detail, even to the very numbering of the hairs of our head. But especially, we see his commitment to his people goes beyond the most tenderest of images that we can conceive and present ourselves. Can a mother forget a suckling child? The tenderness of mother and baby bond. And yes, sad to say, it might yet happen. That bond might yet be broken. And then it goes on to say, but God, he will never, ever go beyond that bond. That's the commitment of God to his people. And so Nahum is calling his people back to these truths into everyday living. God is sovereign. God is jealous. God is patient. God is slow to anger. Days of grace have been given for reflection, for return. They knew this before. Remember, they knew it before. Who did Jonah go to preach to? The Ninevites. What did he say? You've got 40 days. So they knew fine well a time and an opportunity given to reflect and return. But they didn't take the opportunity given. And so the Lord is now jealous to rise up as sovereign and to take them to task for their treatment, but also to deliver and set his people free. He does act against sin and evil and cruelty. A warning then, as Jonah preached to the Ninevites, to repent. But that was forgotten. It no longer operated in their lives. And therefore God is against them. Past privilege is no protection unless these privileges are still effective in our lives. 47 verses describing the fall of a city and the destruction of a nation, simply to encourage God's people who might be down at the bottom of the pile, to encourage them that God indeed is sovereign, and that although that nation, mighty and cruel as it was and is in their day, that city, intimidating, impregnable as they might conclude it to be, but nevertheless God is sovereign over them and over that city, and he did bring them down, and he treated them in the same way as they had treated others. And in a moment the Assyrian nation and their city was left as an empty shell. The veil was drawn over them for 2,000 years. And when they were eventually found, they were as empty as they had made other cities to be. The rise and the fall of empires. The rise and the fall of empires. But God's people are safe in his hand, and his church is still growing and being built and filling with people. I am against you, the word of the Lord to these people, to Nineveh, but an encouragement to those who were beside Nahum, the Lord's people in his day.